Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 18 years of law enforcement analysis experience and 35 years of law enforcement experience overall. He is an instructor, consultant, and even a coach for the Special Olympics. He is a firefighter turned officer turned analyst turned director of learning and development for the National Insurance Crime Bureau. Representing the great state of Washington, please welcome Steve Belts. Steve, how are we doing?
Nice introduction, the great state of Washington. I love it. I'm actually out in the peninsula of Washington, which people don't know a lot about. So I'm kind of 2 hours away from Seattle, which I love.
Oh, very good. Yes, the Pacific Northwest. I've only been there once when the IACA conference was there. It was probably almost like 10 years ago now, but I really, really enjoyed it when we were out there.
It's a nice place to visit. And then we tell people to go away and just leave us alone.
that's one of the characteristics of being from the Pacific Northwest, right?
Exactly.
All right. So you have been on quite an adventure in your career. So how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Actually, it was kind of just fell into my lap. I was in the right place at the right time. So at the time when I was with the Washington State Patrol, I did collision reconstruction. And a little known fact is Washington State Patrol is the first law enforcement agency in the world to use digitized, infrared measuring systems for measuring crime scenes and homicide scenes for that matter. But that all involved into using computers to reconstruct all these crime scenes. And I got pretty good at that. And then they wanted to start the first full-time computer forensic analyst and detective. And I applied for that spot and got it. And that was in 1996, I believe, 1995, somewhere around there. And that's how I got into it. So.
Now, when you were an officer, did the other officers give you a hard time for being a firefighter first? Because I know that can be a love-hate relationship between firefighters and officers.
I still get a lot of comments on that, just to be nice. It's usually the other way around because they want those 24-hour shifts and they can be home for 4 days in a row. But I'm not very good at sitting still. And firefighting was awesome, but career paths were limited. I got there just happened to be a retired Washington State Patrol sergeant that was a volunteer at our agency, and he recruited me into the Washington State Patrol, and it was a blast. I had a great ride in both places.
And then you, as you mentioned, you get into computer forensics in the mid-90s. I didn't do too much computer forensics during my law enforcement career, but I did take a couple of classes, and it's the amount of data is just astonishing. And this would have even been back in the 90s, let alone today. So as you look back, what were some of the initial roadblocks that you were facing?
Well, when I got involved in this, it was basically a DOS-based world when we were talking about anything to do with computer forensics. As far as analysis process, all the DOS tools, Norton Diskette was our go-to. But, you know, the largest hard drive I had at that time was probably 100 megabytes, and we were examining a lot of floppy diskettes as well. And I'm talking about the 5 1/4 floppy diskettes. And so using DOS and those smaller drives wasn't too bad because you could walk sector by sector through the drives and reconstruct and recover data that was deleted fairly easily. It was time consuming, but you could do it. But the drives started getting bigger. And I think it was the late 1990s. They finally started coming out with some more automated tools that were Windows based. InCase was one in particular that we started using. InCase was a Windows based. So it gave us a little bit easier access as these drives started getting larger. But you're right. It can be very hard to manage at times.
So is there any particular cases that you've worked on during this time that are memorable?
You know, we did work a lot of child pornography cases. That was actually, I've got things stuck in my brain I'll never get out because it's just bad. The only happy part I would have about that whole thing was the fact that the child pornographers and child molesters were getting more jail time than some of my homicide subjects. So at least they were getting the book thrown at them, and it needed to be done. I mean, somebody has to do it. And I had my unfair share of it. And I was glad to move on to more of a fraud analysis when I moved over to the federal government. So.
Yeah, and we'll get to the feds here in a second. But I guess, did you find that most of them had a lot of other programs that try to be deceptive and try to hide their files?
Yes, you know, probably most of them just had it on their machines. Passwords were starting to get pushed out and encryption, but, you know, it was still kind of clumsy and clunky, and people are just lazy, right? Mm-hmm. Even today's age, people don't use very good passwords. And we had password cracking programs that if they did password their files in those days, I had a program that usually cracked it within, 30 seconds. So it wasn't that big of a deal. Some of them tried some things to get a little bit elaborate on how they hit them, like they would change the file extension names. But those are the kind of tricks you kind of expect and you look for. So probably the more difficult ones was the financial cases, because the software that they use is very proprietary. And when you're trying to reconstruct their data, you have to have their software for the most part. And if they deleted their software, and I get as so much as one byte that got overwritten, I'm not recovering their software. So those were probably the more difficult ones, but also very rewarding at the same time.
So then, as you mentioned, you become an analyst with the federal government. So take us through the thought process of you're a detective sergeant with the Washington State Patrol, and you're going to make this leap to being an analyst with the federal government.
Yeah, so it was kind of weird. I had been teaching around the country on computer forensics, and pretty much I could almost tell you every job I had, and as you can see, my resume, I've had quite a few, I got because somebody was in the audience of what I was teaching, and they said, hey, we want to do that. Would you come work for us, kind of thing? Mm-hmm. And State Department was no exception. They hired me. Originally, as a contractor, they had a program. This was after 9/11, and they were trying to rebuild their computer forensics program. They hired me, another guy, and one agent. So we had a group of three. We ended up growing it to over 30 people, and I ended up being the lab manager for part of that process. But that was fun, but that's how I got over to the federal side, which led on to some other federal jobs as well.
That's interesting. The State Department was directing that. Because, I mean, normally when you think feds, you think FBI, ATF, DEA, and here it is, the State Department leading the way on that.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, again, this was after 9/11, and the terrorists that came into our country got in under fake passports and visas, which is the State Department's responsibility. So, every federal agency was pouring resources into trying to stop terrorists. And they've got over 600, I believe, embassies and outposts all around the world. So it's an extremely large organization. They're the sovereign, most of those, they're sovereign U.S. soil as far as the embassy is concerned. So any crime that's committed on those properties is considered a American U.S. crime and investigated as such. State Department has their own special agents that investigate those. And we supported all those programs with the computer forensics side of that, and later audio video forensics as well.
So were you able to stay in Washington for this, or was this going to D.C.?
Yeah, I moved to Washington, D.C., actually Fairfax, Virginia for 14 years while I was doing this.
Okay. You'd mentioned you grew it to 50 employees, but then what standards were you able to create? You talked about computer forensics and then the audio video.
Well, I actually wrote a policy manual as we went along, trial and error kind of policy manual, but I think most of them are written that way anyways. But, one of the biggest issues we have in the analysis world is it's really hard to find an analyst. And what I mean is we had plenty of people that were starting to graduate with master's degrees or bachelor's degrees in computer forensics, but that made them book smart. And I found out very quickly that that did not make them an analyst. And until they get to sit down in front of a computer and look at, you know, ones and zeros 8 hours a day, that's not for everybody. I worked some awesome cases, but for example, I just got done with a bank case and it took me over 200 hours to work it.
Wow.
So you have to have a lot of patience, but the rewards at the end are really, really outstanding sometimes. But the hardest part of this whole process was hiring analysts and figure out who was a good fit. So I ended up developing almost, at least for me, was more of a conversational style of interview process, where I wanted to get to know the person. I already can see on paper they've learned how to use all these tools, at least at some level. But what's in their brain? You know, what kind of personality they have? And so I would spend just an hour or more with these folks, not asking them any computer forensic questions at all. We would just talk. And because I was looking for creativity more than anything. And the biggest thing is I want to know if they're teachable and that they've got that, you know, I want to put puzzles together mentality. You know, how do you test for that? I don't know.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask you. Did you have like some go-to questions that you had, or was it just a matter of just sitting down and having small talk and getting to know the interviewee?
Yeah, the only thing I ever walked into an interview with was their resume. And we talked a little bit about it, but anybody can read a resume. So it really was just having a conversation with them. And it worked out very well. I'd have people walk into our labs, all the labs I worked in, and they say, you know, they'd see everybody getting along so great and we're just pumping out really good material. And they'd say, how do you do this? How do you hire these kind of people? And I can't write this out. I can't give it to somebody else and say, here's your checklist, do this. Because it really wasn't like, it was like you and me talking.
Yeah. You must have some special sauce there, because I think hiring's really tough.
Yeah, it is.
I worked with Sean Baer last fall on a hiring guide. We did a 7-part podcast series on hiring, and we went through from beginning to end the hiring process from both the interviewer to the interviewee. It's really difficult, especially when you get maybe a half hour interview with a person. It's really difficult to gauge how he or she's going to fit with the team.
Right. And I was fortunate, you know, I can't say I got it right every time. It, you know, whatever secret sauce I was using worked most of the time. And occasionally I would get permission to get an intern into the group too. And that was a great way to do this. And interns come in all shapes and sizes. So you get some that you know you need to hire. And others, for example, I had one intern. I would give interns cases to work that we already knew the answers to. And then I'd come back and check on them later. I never gave them deadlines because I don't give any of my analysts deadlines unless there's a drop dead date for some reason. They just need to get a quality work done. This one intern, I walked in, I don't know, it was a couple of weeks later. I said, so how are you doing on that case? He said, well, I haven't worked it because you haven't asked me anything more about it. I said, I've got 30 employees here. I don't have time to come in every day and ask you how you're doing on your case. You need to take some initiative on your own part and work on this stuff. So anyway, you get them all shapes and sizes, obviously.
Yeah, internships are important. We've talked about that on this show several times now. I wish there was more internships around the country because it is a way to get the foot in the door. And I think most of the time it's just verifying that you show up every day, you get along with people, you have the work ethic that you talked about. I mean, it's the small things that I don't think you can judge in a 30-minute interview, but you can see over a 6-week or 8-week time frame what type of worker the intern is.
Exactly. It is one of the best ways to do it. It's not always available to you. And as an analyst, if you can get your foot in the door that way, go for it. I don't care if it's a free spot or not. It's if you want to be an analyst intern, it's the best way to go.
So then you're there about 10 years. And during that time, talking about computer forensics, you're also talking about this is also the time with laptops take off and smartphones take off. So you're there with the State Department when all those things start to take off. So how did the new technology make your life more complicated?
It started, and this is the problem with the analysis, the word analysis, because it's a very broad brush. There's so many different specialties with being an analyst. And that happened in the computer forensics world. We now had people that had to specialize in just cell phones, had people that had to specialize in encryption, hard drive to hard drive, whether it's in a laptop or in a computer. So that really wasn't that big of an issue other than learning how to tear it apart or take it apart. So you just started developing all these little specialties. And as the program grew, you had to have evidence people and all kinds of things. So
another thought that I have about this topic is, with you being an officer before an analyst, you had the training there, working patrol, working cases, and learning how to be an officer. I feel that was something that I don't even know if I ever really overcame that aspect as an analyst, because I came in as a civilian. And as I've mentioned on the show a couple of times, I came in, became an analyst at Baltimore, and I was new to even Baltimore, right? I was from Pennsylvania, so I was new to the city, new to the profession, and I struggled with just even understanding the city, let alone how to analyze it. And probably is a good reason why I got more into the data, analyzing the actual data, trying to clean up the data, than getting into some of the issues of the city. And so with that, because you had mentioned bringing in folks and they're straight out of college, there had to be something to be said, though, from your time being an officer, how you were able to be as successful as you were because you were an officer first.
You know, that's a question that I get a lot, actually. Do you want to hire an analyst based on civilian experience because they're a good analyst, or do we want to hire a law enforcement that has law enforcement background and train them to be an analyst? And I don't think there's a really correct answer to that, because it's based on the individual themselves. I do lean a little bit more towards the law enforcement side because we are working criminal cases. So to understand the criminal aspects of what you're working, that goes a long ways to helping you ask the right questions, because that's what you're doing with the data anyways, is you're asking questions. And if you don't know the crime or the mentality of the criminal or any part of that, the legal system, that can be a little tough to learn sometimes. But but in the end, it's really up to the individual.
Before we move on, is there any stories that stick out from your time here with the State Department?
You know, I got to work some really interesting cases. A lot of them I just can't talk about that. But you know, I had the ability to actually travel around the world to a lot of places that weren't so nice and a couple of places that were nice, but it was fun. I mean, when you get into a foreign country and have to work criminal cases from a small embassy or a very large embassy, it's different. You know, you come back just exhausted. I had one case that I worked 79 hours of overtime in an 8-day period because we were trying to catch a terrorist, and I was the lead on the data analysis side of it, and I was up nonstop, including flights to get to different areas of the world to get different tools. So it was quite fun, but you know, it's nice that to have been traveled the world and seen that side of things. So
now you move on to the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board. Is that still with the State Department, or is that outside the State Department now?
No, and it's actually kind of funny. I helped get a contract with DOD and the largest computer forensics lab in the world out there in Lithicum, Maryland. And I was actually a lead in their SCIF there for a while. But at the same time, I'd gotten an offer to interview for the spot on the RATB, the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board. And they needed a supervisor, a assistant director to manage analysts. And so this was during the President Obama era when they were sending out the stimulus dollars. And usually in the fraud arena, we get what we call the pay and chase model, where we get a hurricane or something comes through and the federal government and local government start pouring money into the area to try and get it rebuilt But in this particular case, when we had an economy, the president decided, hey, we got some time on this. Let's try and do this right, not do the pay and chase. So we started up this program, and it was actually under Vice President Biden at the time who the project was reported to. And it was kind of fun. It was under the State Department. So basically I managed a group of analysts that we had access to government data, paid for data, open source data, anything that we had the legal right to be into, to use that data to proactively go after bad guys and bad girls that were stealing money from the federal government. Mm. So it was a very interesting project. And it's only funded for a few years, but just because it was an experiment and it worked. I had a blast on it. So
how did you identify who to target?
Well, it's kind of funny. We had a hotline and also a website place, but honestly, we got a lot of stuff just from the newspaper as well, or listening to a radio station. I know one case that turned into a huge case because one of our people in our group was listening to, I think it was NPR at the time, was coming into work, and they were talking about a couple of doctors that the reporter thinks were stealing money from Medicare program. And so we started digging into it, and we found probably 100 doctors that were using that same ploy in that same area that were doing the same thing. So it was kind of strange how we got some of our cases.
Yeah, it just seems like it would be never ending. Yeah. I can't imagine what the last year has looked like.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny. I get asked about, hey, can we get proactive on this? And the short answer is yes, we can get proactive on anything you want to, but you have to understand what proactive means. First of all, it usually takes a couple of years to set up a good proactive program because you have to study the history first before you can go into the future. Because if you don't understand what happened in the past, you're not going to understand what's going to happen in the future either. And it takes a while to get that going. So not a lot of programs have that kind of patience to do that. But the other part I found was the issue is you can get proactive and get a really good proactive program like what we had going there. But sooner or later, you got so good with the proactive, you're turning reactive. And now you have to react to everything that you proactively found. And so we ended up, I kept charts and graphs on this. So it was kind of funny. We started off, probably 10 so cases a month and grew it up to over 60 cases a month. But it started off mostly proactive. And then you can see the reactive line catching up and eventually passing the proactive side of things.
Yeah. The indicators for fraud, there's probably new ones every week, right?
Oh, yeah. That's why you got to kind of keep your eyes open.
All right. And then why did it end?
It was funded for 5 years, and it ended up getting expanded for 7 years because I think it was Hurricane Katrina that came in up there, and Congress really liked what we were doing. I thought, okay, we'll keep this up and running for a couple more years, but it's politics. It's funded only for so long, and they call it a sunset. At some point, it has to sunset unless somebody, one of the federal agencies, really wants to take it up, because we were not. Although we were a federal program, we weren't a federal agency. So there was nothing really that, we didn't have any mothership to report to, basically.
Well, this brings us to the NICB, but let's take a break first. And then when we'll come back, I want to talk to you about you getting involved with NICB. We'll talk about some analyst issues, and then we'll finish up with your personal interests.
Sounds great. See you in a bit.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
What's going on, analysts? My name is Manny San Pedro. I'm the technology director for the IACA. And here is my public service announcement for analysts. Don't become overly reliant on Excel. Use it to analyze and break down your data. It's a fantastic tool. Fantastic. And it's free as part of the Microsoft Office offering, but don't use it as a database. Use a database as a database, connect to the database with Excel, and then use it for your pivoting, for all your slicing and dicing, even developing your dashboard. But again, don't use Excel for everything, because it may not be the best tool for you.
Hi, this is Scott Eicher, and I am a retired FBI agent, and I just wanted to point out that FBI agents are people too.
Welcome back. All right, Steve, You were talking about retirement, and then NICB comes a call, and I take it.
Yeah. So, again, I'm not very good at sitting still, and my wife was still working. She's a surgical nurse, so working 12-hour shifts. So I actually went online and started taking all kinds of courses and getting different certs out of different computer-related items. But it was kind of backtracking a little bit. Well, let's put it this way. I got a call one night from somebody that worked from NICB saying, hey, we've got an opening for an agent. Would I be interested? And I said, sure. But the reason they even knew my name in the first place, well, two reasons. One is back in the early 1990s when I was with the Washington State Patrol, I actually spent 3 years on a federal task force on insurance fraud on stage car accidents. And I ended up being the main undercover officer just out of a fluke and infiltrated a gang of that was staging car accidents. And it took us 3 years to do this, but we ended up indicting over 30 people out of this, doctors, lawyers, and all kinds of stuff. But at that time, I was also a collision reconstructionist, and we had NICB on our team. They also knew I taught. So they asked me if I wanted to give talks at all their SIU academies, special investigator academies with insurance, and which they hold a couple times a year. And I ended up teaching 10 straight years for those guys, traveling all around the U.S., teaching collision reconstruction and how it relates to staged car accidents. So I had a background with them, and I knew the company very well. In fact, a lot of the people were still there that were back. This was 1992 to 2002. But the person that called me was actually a retired Washington State Patrol detective that I used to work with. He also knew I taught for NICB, and he was now working for NICB. And I had to jump through all the hoops, go through all the interviews, and ended up being offered a spot as a special agent with NICB.
What were your tasks? Because when I think special agent, I'm thinking FBI, DEA. I'm not thinking insurance fraud.
Well, if you could see me right now, you'd see me put my finger on the end of the nose that you hit it. So originally, this 100-year-old agency, first of all, it's a nonprofit that was started way back when cars were starting to get stolen and the insurance companies needed to do something about it. So they formed this nonprofit, and it's evolved in several different ways, but mainly they chip in money, and this group was formed to investigate these cars that were getting stolen. And it's since evolved into any kind of insurance fraud for the most part. So we have over 1,200 member companies is what it's referred to, and their employees and their SIU, their investigators. And as members, we help, we're that liaison between them and law enforcement. Our agents do is work criminal cases. But there was a time and period where a lot of the people that ran NICB were retired FBI agents. And the story I'm giving, I don't know if it's completely accurate, is, you know, that was their thing. That was their titles. And they just brought them over with them when they came. So we've been called special agents ever since then. We don't have any law enforcement powers, but all we do is work criminal cases. But we work them in conjunction with law enforcement and prosecutors. So yeah, it's kind of it's a good question. I usually say I'm an investigator, but.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm picturing that they had their title on a sign for their desk and they just didn't want to change it. So they're like, we're going to be special agents over here now.
So, yeah, exactly. That's a good title.
So then you're the go-between in between the victims and law enforcement then. Is that what you said?
Yeah, mostly between the insurance industry and law enforcement. So, okay. But you do have the victims within the, you know, insurance company is a victim as well, but you got the victims that were part of the staged car accident or the slip and falls and all kinds of stuff. And I tell people, you know, they ask me, well, what kind of stuff do you investigate? And it really is anything from between a slip and fall all the way up to a homicide. Homicide example is I had one case where the husband is suspected of killing his wife through opiate overdose. And the only reason they caught on to that is he had 6 life insurance policies out on her.
Wow.
So I got brought in to help with the data analysis side of all the bank records and such. So
Was that the case? Did he actually really kill her?
It hasn't gone to trial yet. It's still
scheduled. Oh, okay. All right.
But that's that case I had over 200 hours into for the bank records. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So that was one thing. You know, I had my bank card stolen once, and it was right the day before I was going on vacation. So it was just not at a good time. Not that it's ever a good time to have your bank account wiped out. But I found it interesting that eventually my bank gave me the money back. But it was interesting, then I was no longer considered the victim. The bank was considered the victim, which is, it's interesting because as I was kind of curious. I was like, hey, where's this going? It's interesting that I wasn't considered the victim anymore once the bank reimbursed me the money.
You're still a witness, though. In our case, you'd still be a witness, but you're right. You're not the victim anymore. The insurance company would be the victim.
Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with all sorts of fraud cases then with the insurance. So is it normally the insurance is contacting you all to start up a new case?
Very rarely. I mean, it does happen where they'll just pick up, an investigator will pick up a phone and talk, start talking to us about a case. But the way the process usually works is there's a database that's been used for many years that they upload the claim files to, and then they flag them as suspicious. Now they can, and that collects all these different data points out of the file, including giving us access to the claim files at that point. Now, suspicious could mean that they know it was out and out fraud, and they're going to sue whoever it was, you know, or it was just kind of these red flags that were popping up, and they may even paid it out, but just didn't make sense. And so these are distributed. They end up at our headquarters and distributed out to our different regions throughout the U.S. and the regional directors in there assign them to the different agents in that area to work. And so they'll show up on my computer, basically, and I review all the new cases that came in. And as an agent, we get to pick which cases we work because, you know, we get a lot of them. Some of them are just, there's nothing we can do with it. There's just not enough information to work. But then the other ones that have some meat on the bone, so to speak, we'll pick those up and run with them, and then usually work with law enforcement as well. And a lot of states have their own office of insurance commissioner, maybe called something different. And a lot of them have their own investigative entities. Like here in Washington State, they have the Office of Insurance Commissioner and Criminal Investigations Unit, which has detectives that work fraud. And we have a person that's assigned to an agent that's assigned to their team to work cases with them. So
does working for the NICB, I guess, where would you, if you had to pigeonhole it to compare it to one of your other stops in your career, is it more like being the officer? Is it more like being the analyst for the State Department? Or is it more like, you know, being the analyst for T-Mobile? Like, where would you put the NICB?
It kind of depends on the agent. A lot of agents had their different specialties. Some of them were hired because they were auto theft detectives. Some were hired because of their medical investigative backgrounds, because we do work a lot of medical cases as well. My area is data analysis. And so even though I pick up cases, I was that guy that was given all the data to go through. And some of it's like really raw data where I'd have to take claim files, which are PDF files, and pull out data points to create the spreadsheets and show that one person stole $1 million from a whole bunch of different people. But you wouldn't see that by just reading the claim files. It's, you know, not till you get it into a spreadsheet that then add it up that it starts making sense. So for me, it's probably been a little bit of both law enforcement and a good dosing of data analysis along with it.
It sounds like you make it sound so easy, Steve. So, but I mean, all of these are complicated, right? I mean, there's just all these cases, and unless they're just really being blatant, I guess, is most of them pretty complex, or is it so prevalent that it's like shooting fish in the barrel?
You do get the fish in the barrel, the low hanging fruit ones. You get the people that go out and do stupid things, or, you know, get in an accident but don't have insurance, and then they go buy insurance and then report that they got in an accident or something later on. Those are that's a low hanging fruit, but you know, most states that's a felony. In Washington State, anything over $1,500 is a felony. So it doesn't take much car damage to turn that into a felony. So there's the low hanging fruit, but a lot of like the medical cases are extremely complicated. Getting into some of these people that are fraud rings, basically staging car accidents or doing something that commits fraud. These are the people that do this for a living, pretty much. Yeah. It can take years and are very complicated. So it's all over the board.
So just walk us through the process of staging a car accident. I mean, I know that it's going to switch every time, but just generally, just to give the audience an idea of what all is involved.
Yeah, so there's several ways to do it, and I won't get into every particular way, but usually, you know, sometimes they'll have their own gang and they'll borrow somebody's car or get a car, and they'll, as a gang themselves, they'll crash their cars together and just tell law enforcement they don't know each other when in fact they do. Or they'll set up an unsuspecting person. Somebody's, you know, they'll try and get somebody to start tailgating them, and then they'll slam on their brakes and wham, you know, anybody that does the rear ending is the one that's at fault for the most part. And so it's not just the rear end, they'll try all kinds of things. I mean, I've seen them try and stop in front of semis because semis will cause a lot of damage, but they're also deep pockets. You know, they got huge insurance companies backing them up. So, but that's turned tragic when you get the semi truck driver that doesn't notice they stopped and runs right over the top of the car and kills everybody in it. So I have cases just like that. But they get quite creative on this whole process. I've had people that they take hammers and, well, first of all, they'll carry pills with them in the car so to help cushion the blow when they get in an accident. But then they'll take hammers to like their wrists or arm and cause these huge welts or somewhere on their body and bruises. And so they're just strange people. I don't know how to describe it.
So is that where the doctors get involved, create false medical records?
Yeah, or just from the doctor's perspective, it's almost easy because what we're talking about is soft tissue injury, and it's very subjective. You can't x-ray it. You can't do anything to prove or disprove it's there or not there. And so it can be almost very uncomplicated for a doctor to say, yep, he's got a back injury. Let's write it up. So you'll get some in that gray area that they know that, you know, they shouldn't probably be doing this, but they do it anyways. And then you get the ones that are just flat out blatant. They know they're part of this ring and they get hired as figureheads, like the lawyers. You get other people that are really running the clinics, but, and the law offices, but you get the lawyer, the doctors are getting kickbacks for signing the paperwork. So those get quite complicated as well.
So you work in these cases, you're also teaching, and you also go to conferences. NICB going to a conference, what is their goal in going to conferences?
Well, first of all, from an individual standpoint of me and being a teacher, one of two things I try to accomplish when I'm giving a talk. One is they're going to be able to walk away doing what it is I talked about or taught them to do. The other is they were walking away saying, well, I'm not going to be able to do that, but I know who to call now. And that's how that works with NICB. That's how it's worked with any agency that I've worked with. I've used that same method. And so, and a lot of them, you know, that are sitting in that audience aren't going to be able to do what you're talking about, but they find it very interesting. And sure enough, that I was given one talk down in San Diego, somewhere in California, a bunch of AUSAs, and I was talking about the analysis process and visualizing and really doing analysis. And by the time I got to the airport, I had 10 new cases on my phone, basically, them texting me, sending me emails and stuff. So, and that's the same with NICB. We provide a service and people should know about it. So that's the educational process. But at the same time, that's my job to teach people how to do stuff as well.
Anything else that you want to add for NICB before we move on?
No, I'm in the training section now, so that's pretty much all I do. I still carry some caseloads for Washington State and Idaho just to keep my fingers in it on metadata analysis. But other than that, we're just full-time. Training's a big deal for us. We train, we've got over 100,000 people that are members because we train law enforcement for free as well. But we're going every week. We've got at least 5 or 6 instructor-led courses going on. And so literally 10,000 hours a month of teaching going on.
Very good. Very good. So the next topic I want to talk about is an issue that you find with analysis. And that's the idea that analysis, the term, is pretty loosely defined. You've gotten to the point now where analysis, with all the tools that we have at our disposal, has turned into point and click analyst, as opposed to really being data analyst and being a student of the data.
So I give talks or talk with management on a fairly regular basis. And it's one of the biggest issues I come up with is they have the mentality, we just want to buy the software that'll handle this. And we've got AI that's coming out and getting better, but even AI is missing what I call that intuitive point. We're the only people that have intuition right now. AI is getting smarter and is getting better at trying to guess what we want, but that's all it's doing. And it's only as good as the programmer and how they're building that program. And it's going to be a long time before that's ready. So right now we're getting the tools that are getting good at organizing the data and showing us what we think we might want, but we're stopping there. We can't stop there. We've got to get that good analyst in there that knows the data, knows the issues involved with whatever it is they're investigating, and then can ask that questions of the data to get it to that next level. I mean, I talk to analysts now too that, they're printing out reports every week, and you know, you ask them, well, why do you print that report? Well, because I'm asked to. Well, what's a report mean? Well, you know, they're looking at stats of this stuff and that stuff. And I says, does anybody ever use the stats? And you know, the answer is they laugh, mm-hmm. and they say, well, probably not, but I'm asked to do this. And I said, well, that's fine, and I get that, but mm-hmm. you know, some of the ball is in your court. Is your going to have to take it to the next level yourself. You need to ask, what does this data mean? And then explore it and explore with your managers once you come up. And it does two things. Once it gives you the ability, you're training yourself, right? Because you're exploring and asking new questions. And I'm going to be a lifelong learner. I already know that because that's even in my off hours, I'm reading and exploring, right? But that's what you have to be if you really want to carry that analyst label. And they don't know. The best part of this whole thing is they don't know what they don't know. And when I say that, that's the managers. So mm-hmm. they don't know anything about the data. They just know what they think they're supposed to ask and ask you to report on. So if you come up with these other things saying, hey, did you think about this, and then report on it, you know, you're going to be opening their world to them. And that's a good thing, right? And it, mm-hmm. and then you'll start to love your job at the same time because you get to explore and really, you know, use the data.
Be a go-getter, right? And I think that's one of the things that I was able to do early in my career is find out what the purpose is and kind of create my own, I guess, my own sub program or my own set of duties that
right.
then, because just getting into what you were saying, because I was in on the creation part there, there's a sense of ownership and it's a better understanding because I was there from the beginning. I think most of my struggle, especially with a new position, is a product or a program that started before I got there. And I wasn't part of the initial planning process and then trying to really understand all the nuances behind it. That's one thing that I've really struggled with. But if I was in there on the beginning and can read the room and try to understand where they're trying to go with it, it helped me make suggestions and recommendations and then hence have some ownership with the task that came out of that.
Yeah, and there's kind of two guiding principles I've always used, and some of them I didn't realize I was using them until later on, but one is gap analysis. I saw a hole in something that needed to be filled because nobody else was doing it and or that it needed to be done. But at the same time, when I took on a project like that, I learned very early that I need to learn it well enough to teach it to somebody else. But because even if I didn't teach it to somebody else, that made me really good at what I was doing. So if I can't explain it to somebody else, then I don't really understand what I'm doing.
Yeah, and that's always a way to make sure that even when I was studying in college, it was, you know, if I could say it, write it, even spell it, then I, you know, if I could go through all those things, then I knew it. So I can definitely relate to the idea of like, okay, I have to explain this to a person that may not have any idea what's going on, and then I know it. So I can relate to that.
Yeah, and you said the key word there, sell it too. I mean, that's what you're doing. Whatever you're working on, you're selling somebody.
And then, so you actually wrote a paper on this idea called the three-legged stool for data analysis.
It was more of a policy thing that I wrote up. It kind of took off because a couple of different radio shows picked up on it back in DC. So I went onto their shows and had to explain what this was about. So that was fun, but it kind of turned into it was more of a policy paper, nothing that I can really share because it belongs to somebody else now. But
Okay. All right. And then do you have any other advice for our audience? One of the questions that I like to ask is, as you look back in your career, what are you surprised that the law enforcement analyst profession hasn't figured out yet? You know, when you maybe first started back in the early 90s, you'd be like, oh, by 2021, we'll have this and we won't be dealing with these issues anymore. And yet we're still struggling today with this very same issue.
Well, it's nothing that the rest of the world is dealing with, especially the business world, I suppose, the better analogy, because we've got all this data and we thought, oh, we're going to have a great time with it, but we still don't know what to do with it. And there's still too many tools and there's still too many old data versus new data. And it's a mess. And it will be for a long time. So that's one of the biggest things.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, they just want to buy the software mentality.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like we spend very much time making sure the data is correct to begin with. Like the data entry, the very first step of this process that we get stuck, especially as analysts or investigators, we're in the middle, right? It's after the data's in there and we're trying to bring all these different data sets together. And it seems like law enforcement spends a lot of time in the middle and there's not a lot of time and energy spent at the very beginning to make sure that the data is clean, that it's being recorded all in a standard fashion or not, but it seems like there's lots of tools to try to fix bad data and which seems like that's where the money goes is after these tools instead of actually spending the time to get the data right in the first place.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So it's kind of funny. I do obviously teach a lot of classes on data analysis and I got a 5-step plan for data analysis and everybody wants to jump right to step 4, which is analyzing. You know, that's when they do the graphs and make it pretty. Mm-hmm. And they forget that about steps 1, 2, and 3 of finding the data, collecting the data and cleaning up the data. And which is the hardest part, like the bank thing I talked about when I say over 200 hours, that was just on steps 1, 2, and 3. Oof. Step 4 of visualizing, step 5 of reporting were like less than 70 hours. So, it's much easier, but you have to get the steps 1, 2, and 3 first.
Oh, yes, that's for sure. You know, it's work. And I guess that's maybe where it is that people don't want to take the time to do it. They rather, hopefully they can hit a button to do it. But maybe AI, as you said, maybe AI at some point in time will be able to clean bad data. I don't know. Maybe someday, but by that time, we'll probably all be replaced by AI then.
Yeah, if you knew your data source, you can build data dictionaries to actually clean that stuff up. But, you know, the stuff we work with in law enforcement comes from everywhere, and it just doesn't work. So, not yet anyway, but hopefully AI.
All right. Well, very good. Let's finish up with your personal interests, because you are a coach for the Special Olympics, at least before the pandemic. But how did you get started with coaching?
Well, it was kind of funny. A long time ago, when my kids were growing up, I was in Little League and ended up being president of Little League. And we had a Challengers League within Little League, which was our special needs kids playing baseball and softball and such. And so I thoroughly enjoyed working with that. And then as I started to become an empty nester here, I started looking around, that's probably 7 years ago, and of something to volunteer and do. And this just popped up right in front of my face. And I thought, wow, this is going to be awesome. So I started getting involved in it for the city of Renton. Actually, out here, they have a Renton adaptive program. They sponsor Special Olympics. And I started volunteering for them. And I ended up coaching five different teams, like softball, football, soccer, golf, and basketball. It was not without incident. I broke a rib once practicing softball with them. they're a blast. But when COVID hit, it all got shut down. Sure. But I still meet up with them twice a week. Actually, I'm back down to once a week now. Wednesday nights, we meet up via Zoom and have live. We do all kinds of, you know, talent shows and things like that. In fact, tonight, I'm taking them out. I've got my wife and I have 10 acres outside of town here that we're building a house. So I'm going to take them out there on live camera and walk them around the property and show them around. So it should be fun.
What is the age group?
I call them my kids, but I really shouldn't do that because they're anywhere from 16. I've got two golfers on my team that were over 70. So they're all over the place. I think the majority are probably 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. But they really are all over the place. So,
okay.
But they're a blast to hang with. They just want to have fun. And we always have fun. And we're catching grounders. And I reached for a long one. And I end up doing a body roll. I caught it, but I did a body roll. And they're all laughing. And the parents are sitting in the stands. And they're saying, great, coach. Good job. And everybody's cracking up. And the next day, I had to go to the doctors and found that I broke a rib and I rolled across the ground.
Yeah, you're taking extreme coaching.
Yep, exactly. My wife broke a finger helping me with basketball practice. So it's tough getting old. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It definitely is. So hey, is the goal then to eventually make that? Is there a state Olympics that you guys are trying to do tryouts for or try to work your way up for? Is this mainly just recreational?
No, it's serious Special Olympics for the most part. The golfing is just recreational stuff. Okay. But like my soccer team, we've been to state many times, but we finally won 1 year. So
nice. You said the county. So is this a government program or a nonprofit or a private program?
No, it's Special Olympics is its own private nonprofit, I assume, program all around the world, from what I know, with the U.S. Special Olympics program. It's just that these different entities kind of take up the mantle, so to speak, in the local areas. So it's usually the cities or the counties that, you know, help the programs because they usually have their own internal programs going on for special needs programs. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a natural forum.
And then were you able to do much golfing recently?
Yeah, actually, I'm just getting back into it again because, as you can tell, I'm kind of a busy guy. But I was in Eastern Washington last week on a 4-day golf tournament in 100-degree weather. So it was a lot of fun. It was just a fundraiser. We had a blast. So, I'm trying.
Did you ever do your handicap? What was the best handicap you ever had?
Oh, geez. I was in the teens. I was on the golf team in high school, but I went for like 20 years without playing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it was 3 or 4 years ago. It was about 3 years ago. I started picking it up again. I was taking it seriously. And then I broke the rib and that kind of wiped me out the rest of the year. And, you know, things just get in the way. It'll settle down. I try to get out once a week now, but I'm nowhere near that handicap. I'm really struggling, but I'm having fun struggling too.
Nice. And you mentioned building a house. Is this the first house that you've ever had built?
Yeah, so my brother does that actually. He's like on his fourth, I think, final house he's built. Okay. But that's never been my thing. I've always gone off and done other things. But yeah, I'm not going to be hands-on. I'll be hands-on with some of it, but I've got a contractor that's handling it. But my wife and I did the whole design of the place, and it's going to be our final place. And it's been an interesting experience. We got the well in, and we've got PUD coming out and ground cleared, and some of the paperwork's already been cleared by the county. So we're getting there. But
when I was in college, I worked for a guy that owned a restaurant. I would do maintenance for him, and he had a house built, and he had me working over there. And he always told me, he's like, people don't understand when you have a house built, how many decisions you have to make. And there's incredible how many decisions you have to make. He would say, just even take like a closet. Like, you're going to be answering like 10, 15 questions just about a closet in one room. So did you find that process fun during the design, or I guess it's still early yet?
It was sort of fun. And my wife actually took up most of that process, because I'm a simple guy. All I wanted was make sure I had a shop and make sure I could come in and sleep every night. And so, of course, she had a good time with that. But so she took up most of that. And we probably went back and forth with the builder, half a dozen times on decisions and stuff on the final house plan. But you're right. It's just there's so many different steps and stuff I have no clue about. So yeah, I'm learning.
Yeah. I hope the lumber prices aren't beating you up too much.
Yeah, I was talking to the builder about it last week. He says he's already seeing the starting to drop, so we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World, and this is where I give the guest the final word. Steve, you can promote any idea that you wish, but what are your words to the world?
Wow, that is a tough one. You know, I'm going to stick to the analyst theme, and because we talked about the broad brush, really kind of what I want to hammer home in this is figure out what you want to do, because it is a broad brush. You can take so many different training paths on this stuff. Are you going to work intelligence? Are you going to work criminal cases? Are you going to work business? I mean, businesses, just open up any job site and you'll see 100 ads for people looking for business analysts. It's just, you can write your own ticket. Now, if you're really good, then get into the intelligence world and get your clearances, you could probably write your own ticket there too, because they're really hurting as well. So just kind of figure out what you want to do and go with it. Have fun with it. Explore. That's what being an analyst is. So.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Okay.
But I do appreciate you being on the show, Steve. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Elder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.